Now, this is a sutta that has to do with one form of right speech, which I generally call admonitory speech, admonition, you know, rebuke, or constructive criticism. And it also has to do with constructive praise. And we'll also consider a little bit of another sutta. It's 139, but just a bit of that later. So in this sutta, Prince Abhaya, who is the son of King Bimbisara, one of the sons, but not next in line to be the king, goes to see Mahavira, the Naganta Nataputta, the head of the Jains. And there's a rivalry, at least as far as the Mahavira is concerned. He's in rivalry with the Buddha, and so he's doing everything he can, according to the suttas, to prove the Buddha wrong. So he enlists the aid of Prince Abhaya for some reason, and Prince Abhaya agrees to go and try to refute the Buddha. I'm just giving a general idea of what it's all about ahead of time, so it's not so hard to follow. You may not understand my reading. So he goes with a proposition. Now, this is in the time of Devadatta, when Devadatta was trying to form a schism, group of bhikkhus, and was trying to actually take over the Buddha's position as head of the Sangha. And so the Buddha had said, not directly to Devadatta, but had said that basically Devadatta was going to go to hell because of what he was doing. And so this the Jains had a avihingsa. Do you know what that means? Non-harming. Their principle of non-harming, which is common also to Buddhism. And I guess this contravened their idea of avihingsa or non-harming. And so he was going to try to prove that the Buddha was not acting correctly. And so he asked Prince Abhaya to go there and ask the Buddha a tricky question. And so that's the setup for this. And in explaining to Prince Abhaya why he gives the answer he does, he gives us this various principles of how to give correct speech when you're rebuking someone or when you're not rebuking someone, and so on, in various categories, which you can see on here. And when you read it, it's a little bit confusing. It's a little easier to see it in a chart form. That's why I did it like that. So you can consider it that way. So I'll start and read it out. And if somebody doesn't understand something or wants to ask a question while I'm reading, just say, raise your hand. I may not see you, so say, my name is Sangharatana. You can just say venerable or something. I guess that's it. 58. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Then Prince Abhaya went to the Naganta Nataputta, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. Thereupon, the Naganta Nataputta said to him, "Come, Prince, refute the recluse Gotama's doctrine, and a good report of you will be spread to this effect. Prince Abhaya has refuted the doctrine of the recluse Gotama, who is so powerful and mighty. But how, venerable sir, can I refute his doctrine? Come, Prince, go to the recluse Gotama and say, 'Venerable sir, would the Tathagata utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others?' If the recluse Gotama, on being asked thus, answers, 'The Tathagata, Prince, would utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others,' then say to him, 'Then, venerable sir, what is the difference between you and an ordinary person? For an ordinary person would utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others. But if the recluse Gotama, on being asked thus, answers, "The Tathagata, Prince, would not utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others," then say to him, "Then, venerable sir, why have you declared of Devadatta Devadatta is destined for the states of deprivation. Devadatta is destined for hell. Devadatta will remain in hell for the eon. Devadatta is incorrigible. Devadatta was angry and displeased with that speech of yours. When the recluse Gotama is posed this two-horned dilemma by you, he will not be able to either throw it up or gulp it down. If an iron spike were stuck in a man's throat, he would not be able to either throw it up or gulp it down. Note this simile. So we'll see a simile later, and we'll see how these similes work to support the theme of this, which is right speech. A form of right speech. So to Prince, when the recluse Gotama is posed this two-horned question by you, he will not be able to either throw it up or to gulp it down. Yes, Venerable Sir, Prince Abhaya replied. Then he rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Nigantanatha Buddha, keeping him on his right, he left and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he sat down at one side, looked at the sun, and thought, "It is too late today to refute the Blessed One's doctrine. I shall refute the Blessed One's doctrine in my own house tomorrow." Now, to me, this sounds a bit, if you think about it, it sounds a bit like, well, he's not really trying very hard to ask the question. Maybe he really wants the Buddha to come to his house, and maybe he's a little more interested in the Buddha's doctrine than Nigantanatha Buddha. I mean, it sounds a little bit, you'll see what I mean later. Then he said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One, with three others, consent to accept tomorrow's meal from me." The Blessed One consented in silence. Maybe that's why he went there in the first place. Then, knowing the Blessed One had consented, Prince Abhaya rose from his seat, and after paying homage to him, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then, when the night had ended, it being morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went to Prince Abhaya's house and sat down on the seat made ready. Then with his own hands, Prince Abhaya served and satisfied the Blessed One with various kinds of good food. When the Blessed One had eaten and had withdrawn his hand from the bowl, Prince Abhaya took a low seat, sat down at one side, and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, would a Tathagata utter speech, as would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others?" "There is no one-sided answer to that, Prince." "Then, Venerable Sir, the Nigantas have lost in this." He sort of capitulated pretty fast, didn't he? He didn't argue. "Why do you say this, Prince?" Then, Venerable Sir, the Nigantas have lost in this." Prince Abhaya then reported to the Blessed One his entire conversation with the Nigantanatha Buddha. Now, on that occasion, a young, tender infant was lying prone on Prince Abhaya's lap. Then the Blessed One said to Prince Abhaya, "What do you think, Prince? If while you or your nurse were not attending to him, this child were to put a stick or pebble in his mouth, what would you do to him?" "Venerable Sir, I would take it out. If I could not take it out at once, I would take his head in my left hand, and crooking a finger of my right hand, I would take it out even if it meant drawing blood. Why is that? Because I have compassion for the child." There again, you have another simile, like the other one that the Nigantha spoke, that has to do with something caught in the throat. It's an ironic kind of reflection, I think. Interesting. "So, Prince, such speech as the Tathagata knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Now, this is what the chart, this paragraph is like laid out on this chart. And we'll just go through, I'll just go through and read this, and then later we'll look at the chart maybe a little bit more closely. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true and correct and beneficial, but which is unwelcome and disagreeable to others, the Tathagata knows the time to use such speech. 6.13, let me just read the note that Bhikkhu Bodhi has for that. In other words, the Buddha does not hesitate to rebuke and admonish his disciples when he sees that such speech will promote their welfare. Next, such speech as the Tathagata knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, but which is welcome and agreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, and which is welcome and agreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true, correct, and beneficial, and which is welcome and agreeable to others, the Tathagata knows the time to use such speech. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has compassion for beings. And you notice this category, which is on here, I put timely, which might be not the best word to use, but in other words, the Buddha, doesn't just blurt something out without thinking. He's mindful and an example for everyone to think about what you're saying and why. He knows the time, but it doesn't go into any definition about what the time might be. Here, Venerable Sir, when learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders, and learned recluses, after formulating a question, go to the Blessed One and pose it. Has there already been in the Blessed One's mind the thought, if they come to me and ask thus, I shall answer thus? Or does that answer occur to the Tathagata on the spot? Now, why does he ask this? This doesn't really follow from what the previous paragraph had, but it sounds very much like, and I'm sure that he's referring to his own question and asking the Buddha, in other words, Buddha, did you know that I was coming and that I would ask this question ahead of time and formulate an answer? Or did you answer the question spontaneously? He's asking about his own question. In my opinion, that's how I read it. Anyway. As to that prince, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, prince? Are you skilled in the parts of a chariot? Yes, Venerable Sir, I am. What do you think, Prince? When people come to you and ask, what is the name of this part of the chariot? Has there already been in your mind the thought, if they come to me and ask me thus, I shall answer thus? Or does the answer occur to you on the spot? Venerable Sir, I am well known as a charioteer, skilled in the parts of a chariot. All the parts of a chariot are well known to me. That answer would occur to me on the spot. So too, Prince. When learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders, and learned recluses, after formulating a question, then come to the Tathagata and pose it, the answer occurs to the Tathagata on the spot. Why is that? The element of things has been fully penetrated by the Tathagata, through the full penetration of which the answer occurs to the Tathagata on the spot. Well, that's a mouthful, and the note, if you're interested, says... And that's what this note, the element of things. What is the meaning of that? 6:14. And the commenter says that word, the element of things, Dhammadhatu, element of things, refers to the Buddha's knowledge of omniscience. It does not mean what's something that's used in the Abhidhamma, with the same term is used in the Abhidhamma. It just means, in general, that the Buddha is aware of the things that have to do with the human heart, in a sense. When this was said, Prince Abhaya said, "Magnificent, venerable sir, magnificent, venerable sir, the Blessed One has made the Dhamma clear in many ways. From today, let the Blessed One remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life." So, sudden conversion there. So it seems to me that he possibly had this in mind from the very beginning, and was really happy to have an opportunity to talk to the Buddha and see his wisdom, and had no problem switching, if he did switch, from the Jains to the Buddhists. But anybody have a question so far concerning this? Okay. Yes. Prince, it means Prince Abhaya, Abhaya Rajakumara. Raja is king, Kumara is prince or son. So it simply means to the Prince Abhaya. Mm-hmm. Now on this, does everyone who wants a chart have it? Because I have more if you need it. And so this sutta doesn't consider all types of right speech, and you've probably been coming long enough so that you know the different categories of right speech. I mean, it doesn't take into consideration really useless speech, sanpapalapa, and certain other things. It has to do with really with a teacher's admonition of a student, in a sense. But we can expand from that and see when we're talking to other people, and we may have some kind of criticism of them, then how do we say it, or should we say it even? And in general, it's sort of a rule of thumb that if you're criticizing other people, are you working on other people when you should be working on yourself? I mean, other people's defilements are for them really to deal with, unless there's really a real serious problem. You see what I mean? But if a person is in a position as, say, abbot, teacher, and so on, sometimes they need to rebuke a student or give them admonition. That's part of their job, to sort of train, you know, like a wild elephant. You know, they have a sutta in here that compares teaching a student to teaching a wild elephant. We have these wild defilements in us, and how do they train a wild elephant? You know, they have to kind of push it one way and another and keep it on the right track. And if the teacher sees that a student's going off in the wrong track and that it could be dangerous for them, then he has to give them some sort of admonition. But there are different ways to do that. And so that's part of what this chart is. So let's go back over that. And I'm just going to go from the chart, but it follows the course of the paragraph. And if you want any part of that paragraph read again, I will. So we have speech, and the categories are true and correct, and apparently they're separated, and I can think of a reason why. True, correct, beneficial, which has to do with motivation. Welcome. And I've included welcome in the other word that was used there. And timely, in other words, a judicious choice of the time in which to say what needs to be said. And then spoken or not spoken, actually used. And so the first one, now I've characterized that as lies or slander. That's just my take on what it means. If it's not true and not correct, and it's not beneficial to someone, then, and it's not welcome, then saying it would be hurtful to them. So it would be some kind of incorrect kind of criticism that would be, and what would be the motivation for that? It would be to hurt the person, somehow gain power over them by degrading them in some way. And, you know, there are cults which specialize in that. They tear a person down without regard to what, you know, to anything within the person, in order to gain power over them. So this is not spoken by the Buddha, of course. We wouldn't think it would be. Lies, slander, and that sort of thing. So the next one, It's true and correct, and it's not beneficial, and it's not welcome, and it's not spoken by the Buddha. And so what would that be? That would be, the way I take it, is some kind of unconstructive criticism that whatever it is that they're saying is true and correct, but it really doesn't do much good to tell the person whatever it is for whatever reason. It's some kind of it's going to be taken as an insult or hurtful. So maybe by thinking about it, you can work out examples of that on your own. It's not welcome. It's not beneficial. For whatever reason, the teacher can see that saying something about a defect in the person is not going to help them, at least at that time. Maybe if the person is in a few years is a little more advanced, then they can say it. You see, maybe they can say it if this person's a little stronger, but if they say it at this time, the person may leave the path. So it takes a teacher to know that sometimes. The next one, it's true and correct. It's beneficial to say it. It's not welcome. However, it is spoken by the Buddha at the right time. So the Buddha has, and what I've called, this is the basic part of this, the sutta, admonition or constructive criticism. Now, in the case of the example given by Nigantha Nataputta about what the Buddha said about Devadatta, I'm not sure that, I mean, that sort of goes beyond anything in this chart. Although Devadatta, maybe if he had a little bit more of an open heart, maybe he would have been so shocked by what the Buddha said he would have changed his tune, and so then you could consider it a very stern, strong rebuke. But at any rate, for ordinary people and ordinary rebukes, if it's necessary, then a teacher like the Buddha or an abbot or someone who knows the students, then they can administer an admonition, or they should administer an admonition or a rebuke if they can see that it's going to help the person and it's necessary to do it at that time, and they pick the right time. Now, the problem is that a lot of times people's defenses come up when you're trying to give them an admonition. I'm sure you've seen that in other people and yourself, that you get defensive. So somehow the teacher has to get through to them, either maybe by a direct stern rebuke, or maybe by another category, which we'll consider in a minute, which would be indirect and direct speech. There's different ways to say things to people. You don't always have to say them directly. In fact, most teachers, from my experience, when they want to get something across to a student, like an admonition, they'll do it indirectly. They won't address the student directly. They'll give a talk, and within the talk, they'll include something about the subject matter. For instance, say the teacher sees that this person has been given to a little bit of lying once in a while, and they feel that they need to give them an admonition about it, rather than saying to them anything directly like "stop lying," or which would, as I said, bring up the defenses of the person, would say, "I'm not lying," you know, and just wouldn't hear it, or even saying, starting a talk and looking right at the person and say, "This talk is about lying." That's not the best, most effective way. But they might give a talk about right speech. Now, within the talk about right speech, one of the categories is lying. So they would just go through, and hopefully the message would come at a time when that person would be open and hear it, maybe right after the person has been lying, and maybe the teacher is aware that person knows that he's been lying too. So it takes a little bit of sensitivity to the person's mental state. Okay, and In the next group we have, it is not true, it is not correct, it is not beneficial, but it's welcome, and it's not spoken by the Buddha. So what is this? So, to me it sounds like flattery. It's some way to praise somebody in a way to manipulate them, possibly, gain power over them. Flattery, why do people flatter other people? Why do they say something in praise? I would say this is probably in praise. If it's welcomed by the person, what is the motivation for doing that? Do we do that? Now, this is my take on it. If you have another point of view, and if you can see a different way, please tell me. I'd like to know another way to look at it, if there is another way. Because I'm just using my own mind and my own, experience and trying to interpret how you'd characterize these different categories. But I'd say basically flattery would fit into that. And the next one, it is both true and correct. True and correct, yes. Beneficial, no. And welcome, yes. And it's not spoken by the Buddha. So what is that? It's some sort of like praise about something the person maybe has done or is, or some quality the person, maybe they have, maybe they have a very good memory, or they're very intelligent or something. And it's another type of flattery that inflates the person's vanity. And why would a person do that? What's the motivation for saying that? Well, there again, it could be a kind of manipulation or bonding with friends, praising your friends, and criticizing your people you don't consider your friends. And then the last one, it's both true and correct. It's beneficial, yes. And it's welcome, yes. And so the Buddha does, at the right time, would say this. And what kind of sort of thing? Well, I would call that justified recognition, because what's the motivation? It's good sometimes to give a student or whoever you're talking to some kind of support, and you acknowledge them. If it's justified, you give them some acknowledgement, and it shows them and shows others, I guess, in particular the person, that they've made some progress, for instance. That's just one example. That they have made progress, that they're not sitting in a hole in the ground. If the person has a kind of personality where they think they're never getting anywhere, the teacher might say, yes, you can say, last year you were doing this, and this year you're doing this. You've made progress. But it wouldn't go into a kind of flattery of their ego. So it isn't a type of manipulation, it's simply a recognition. Okay, so there is another category, and as I was talking about direct and indirect speech, in another sutta, this is in Sutta 139, the exposition of non-conflict. Just wait a minute. Let me find this here. Okay. This has to do with what they call covert speech and overt sharp speech. Now, I would say that covert seems a bit strong, and I believe what he's talking about is indirect and direct speech. Now, there's another way you can administer covert speech or indirect. I would call it indirect speech, which you've probably seen. A teacher wants to get something across to a student, a kind of rebuke or a warning or something like that, and they'll say it to somebody else, within earshot of the person they're actually talking to. I don't know if you've ever experienced that or seen that happen. Or maybe it's happened to you. And that, but then there's a problem with people thinking that the teacher is always talking to them or always mentioning their faults. So a student can fall into the trap of thinking that the teacher is always talking about their problems or this or that. That's a common thing that happens when you have very, very high regard for a teacher and think they're omniscient. So it says, one should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt sharp speech. And then it goes through the categories, more or less, that we just went through. You know, when it's untrue and unbeneficial. So that's sort of obvious. The Buddha wouldn't say that. When one knows overt sharp speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. It doesn't say you shouldn't, but try not to utter it. That's overt sharp speech. That's a direct rebuke. And sharp. A sharp rebuke, which is true, correct, and unbeneficial. One should try not to utter it. But one knows overt sharp speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it knowing the time to do so. So that's partly has to do with what we were saying in admonition, in this chart that has to do with admonition. Now, on covert, let me see. I'm trying to find the part on covert. Ah, yes. Okay. That was over. But one knows, okay, on covert sharp speech. When one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it knowing the time to do so. Now that is what we were talking about before, when I was, giving the example of, giving a talk and, about, right speech in which the teacher wants to talk about lying or give a message about lying to someone. That, I would say, is indirect, and it may or may not be sharp. But one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it. So it gives a justification for using indirect speech, in other words. That's why I'm mentioning this, that it doesn't have to always be a direct rebuke. It can be indirect. So that's supported by that sutta. And that's 139, as I said. And that the name of that is the exposition of non-conflict. All right. All right. So now I have questions in ways to sort of look at this. Is it possible to have something that's true and incorrect? You see that they always follow here as if they were the same thing, true and correct, these categories. You have no, no, yes, 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 no, no, yes, yes, and yes, yes. You never have true, yes, and correct, no. Is it possible? Well, let me give you an example that I thought of and see if you think. You can be the judge if you think that that fits into here, even though it's not mentioned. Let's say that somebody sees a bhikkhu, a monk, go into another monk's room, and that monk is, the second monk is gone, and he takes something out of the room, and he takes it away. And so he reports to the teacher, that monk was stealing something from the monk who's away. Well, okay, it's true that the monk went in and took something. But when they question the monk, they find out that the second monk who is away, gave permission to the first monk to use anything in his room so he could take anything in the time period that he was gone. So it isn't correct. It was incorrect, the judgment. See, and why did I think about this? I'm trying to understand what these two categories mean, why they're different. Is there a difference between true and correct? And I'd say, Yes, probably there's a slight difference depending on the way it's judged, and that's the example that I came up with, and you may be able to think of a better example. And why I'm going into detail on that is that if you look through these categories and you kind of think about it, it gives you more sensitivity to your own speech. Now, the other one is, and I've heard big arguments about this, if something is false, in other words, untrue, and beneficial, is that possible? Is it possible to be untrue and still beneficial? I'm sorry, let me say that. Is false and beneficial, is that possible? And should it be spoken? Yes. But is it a lie? Is it a lie? They say judicious lying. Could you give an example? Could you give an example? I think I know what you mean. I think I've seen this. Yes, exactly. So you might exaggerate. You might. Yes, yeah. Yeah. Goes into too much detail and it goes way over the people's head. Whereas if you just give a broad brush stroke and say all of this is such and such, for the time being everybody thinks, well, that category is such. But if you get into it, it's not that simple. Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's one. That's different. I had never thought of that. I know a teacher who tended to do that, and it bothered me, but now I see maybe I shouldn't have been so critical, that they tended to exaggerate things, and they tended to say, all of such and such is such and such. And you're like, well, that's not true. But for the level of people, perhaps that was the best thing to say. Yes? Mm-hmm. No. Yes. Supposedly, yeah. Yeah, maybe it's more for the benefit of the family so that they're not bothered by, you know. Yeah. I would have to say that's probably not very good, but that's just my opinion. What do you think? Do you think that's a good thing or not? I think it's better to be straight with the person and just tell them the facts. Right. Yeah. Oh. Thank you. That's good. Well, here, anybody else? Before I give my brilliant idea. Here's the one that I've heard an argument about. This had to do with Second World War. Anyway, say the Nazis come to a house say the SS comes to the house, or I guess it would be the Gestapo, and they're looking for Jews that are hidden, and say this house has some Jews hidden in the attic. Well, actually, it's interesting as an aside that I heard this in a talk that I think it was a Dutch reverend who was very well respected, highly respected, and this is when Holland was occupied, came to the door and he was very authoritative, and he says, "Well, if you don't believe me, just go look for yourself." You know, no, and the police or the Gestapo, whoever it was, just went away. They just accepted that. But in general, the idea is this: if harmful people come to you and they're looking for someone, for instance, and you know where that person is, should you lie or not? Now, I know a teacher who says you should never lie and break a precept. You should never lie at all, you know, if you're following the five precepts, and that you really can't lie. And other people just don't agree with that and say, well, but look, you know, you aid and abet, say, a criminal or someone, and they harm or kill another person, actually you would be liable. I mean, you could be prosecuted. So is it really better? And which is the lesser of two evils also? Anybody have a take on that? So in other words, I'm saying that this is false, but it could be beneficial. And should you or should you not? I mean, this isn't on this list. It's sort of a provocative. Oh. Yes, I've never heard anyone say that. Yeah, you could. Yeah, you could. They'd probably torture you. You could also say, just not say anything. You just not say anything at all. Maybe. Or you could kind of prevaricate and kind of say, well, they might be here, they might be there, or they might, without sort of like actually saying anything, you know? How some people talk generally anyway, sort of like, they're waffling, they're talking, but they're not really saying, coming out with any real information. Yes? Oh. Really? It's turned out to be false. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe, possibly only in extreme cases where they're absolutely sure the person is. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Really, yeah. Thank you. That's a difficult one. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, I must say that's my opinion too, although I'm not sure right. Certainly if a person's life is at stake. Yeah. Right. Well, I agree with you. But there are teachers, And my preceptor is one who argued the opposite. We should never lie. Well, I'd be careful about applying that to everything. but I see your point. I'm not sure you can apply that to precepts. I'd hesitate to say, well, you know, you should only drink 3 beers and not 10 or something like that. It's the middle way just to drink 3 beers. Yeah. Well, No, I see your point, and I tend to agree with you. I wouldn't call it the middle way, but I'd hesitate that, but I agree with you in principle. Yeah, okay. All right. Let's see, what else? I found this really useful because in looking at these categories, I realized that the effect that it would have on me is that I would be a little more mindful or conscious or sensitive to motivation, whether something is beneficial or not, and what would be my motivation for saying certain things. I sort of alluded before to, you know, there's a tendency when you have conflicts with people and they might not be your friends to criticize them, but to praise your friends. You know, why do we do that? You know, there's this kind of bonding, and also, you know, you bind with friends and you kind of tend to manipulate, people manipulate each other. You get people to do what you want. I don't know if you've seen that or you agree with me or not agree, but you can become, a little more sensitive. Now, I stress that this is really something for teachers or somebody in a position where it's their job to give admonishment. I don't think it applies to everybody, and that's why I don't think this can be called just right speech in general. I've had people argue that this can apply to everybody all the time, but I don't agree because, as I said before, it's like criticizing people is like doing work on them and not work on yourself. They have their defilements and need to work on them, unless there's a serious problem and that somebody has to be told, you know, not to do something because they might injure themselves, they might injure somebody else. That's different. But to say things to people that are hurtful or unwelcome and disagreeable, then why would you do that? You know, unless you were in the position and it was your job to do something at certain times, and you were, as I said, you picked a judicious time to do it, a good time to do it, when the person was open enough and that you see that they could change, and you can get past their defenses. It's a problem in giving people instructions that they have their defenses up, as I said. Usually you can't really directly tell people things because maybe they think they're already okay, or they think they're way ahead of the game and they already know what you're telling them. There's always some ego defense if you say things directly to people. I don't know if you've noticed that in yourself or other people, but it's a lot, probably a lot more skillful to use indirect speech in a lot of cases if you're ever in a position like that. But there again, I'm not advocating people go out and look for chances to criticize other people and rebuke them. This is not about that. This is about the Buddha, what the Buddha said to Prince Abhaya and the different categories, and it was specifically related to what the Buddha said about Devadatta. And so that's on a real serious, high level. It's not everyday criticism. So that's the origin of the sutta. And really, that's about all I had to say, unless people have questions. Yes. Mm-hmm. 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 Yes. Yes, and that's based on the teacher's experience and knowledge. That's why this wouldn't necessarily apply to everybody. I would say that a teacher in that position should be able to have the experience with a lot of other students over many years. Oh, that's an expansion of what it meant. I hadn't thought of that, but beneficial really means to the beneficial to the individual. Pardon me? Well, I wouldn't say it was abusive. Ah, well, that's a little bit different. That's a different category, which isn't really part of this. That's a different thing. You would have to be on a pretty high level being a teacher to do that. Pardon me? Yes. I see. And actually, it was true of the person that they did that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you. Are you asking a question or just stating this as a possibility? I agree with that. That's a good point, and I hadn't really thought of it. Hmm? Real world examples. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, and it is true, and I've seen that. That also applies to what they call general punishment, where especially in military classes or so on, or with the monks, where somebody does something wrong, but everybody gets punished, right? Like in a military school, that happened. Well, I don't know. That's a matter of what you think is ethical and not. It depends that if the people are there against their will. If they're there to be trained, then those, you know, sort of like those are the rules of the game. But that's not very subtle. And what I've been more interested in here is more of the kind of subtle indirect teaching. I mean, that's a rather a club, use of a club. It's really, really kind of crude form of manipulating people by having all the friends get down on that person, because they've been punished along with that person. So that's used like in basic training in the army. You know, that's the kind of thing that you find there. So hopefully, well, actually that happened with some people, some monks, you know. They were late. One was late, so everybody had to wait for the teacher to come back. I mean, the teacher took a half hour because one person was slightly late. Teacher took about a half hour to come, or maybe not quite that long, but everybody had to wait, so it can happen. But that's, I wouldn't call that abuse. It could be, though. Mm. 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 Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're right. Well, there's different ways to handle it, and there again, it depends on the experience of the teacher and also his personality. and how he relates to the people, and it certainly depends on the level of the student. I mean, maybe, you know, that has a lot to do with it. If the person has been a monk for a long time, they can take a lot more, and they may get a lot more. If they're new and green, the teacher's more likely to be very gentle with them, you know, because you can't you can't go too far; the twig will break, you know. You mean that they're not giving examples? Oh. If I understand you right, you know, all I can say is that using Ajahn Brahma as an example, there's no one more gentle than him. Yeah, that's. I'm surprised that Krishnamurti would say that, and I don't know the reason, so I certainly can't judge it. I don't know. That would be. I can't judge it, especially going from this, because I don't know what's true, correct, beneficial, welcome, plainly. I suppose it was unwelcome, but I don't know if there's anything that it's based on. So it's impossible to judge. Right. Yeah, you'd think that a more compassionate person might have, but he may have had some reason that we don't know. We don't know what his relationship, he may know that person really well. And maybe that was something that would help the person, but it's really hard to say. So I would hold back from judging him. Although what you can say is that you yourself shouldn't do that. Right? That's all you can say. It's doing your work on yourself, you know, not him. Yeah. Yeah. Too quick to judge, yeah. Thank you. Okay. Last chance. I don't have anything to add, and I appreciate your comments. It's helped me to understand this better. Yes, sir. The straight line means not applicable, because the right time only applies to the occasions, the two occasions when the Buddha would actually use that kind of speech. And the other times, it doesn't apply at all. And timely is not the best word, but that was I was in a hurry to get some word, and it means the picking the time. When the student is able to take what you say in, however you say it, whether it's indirect, direct, and so on, all that we've talked about. Picking the time, because blurting things out is not a real good idea. And there's some sutta in which someone does that. Somebody blurts something out. I can't remember what it is. It's really interesting. But you see that the whole teaching is that you're mindful and you see what you're going to do. It's mindfulness and clear comprehension of what you do. You know, if I'm going to stretch my hand out, the idea is that you're mindful of the action, what the reason for it is, how you do it, is it appropriate, and the results. All of these things are things that we're supposed to apply to everything we do. It's not so easy, but certainly speech is very important. It's very important to watch your speech and not to say things to people without kind of reflecting on why and how it's going to affect them. You know? Common sense, really. We don't use speech to manipulate and to manipulate people and sort of beat them over the head. And I'm afraid parents do that with children a lot if they're not very compassionate. So, thank you for coming. It was nice being here.